Well, welcome to Talking History. Today we have Josh Freeman, Professor of History at Queens College in the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and the Director of Queens College Labor Studies Program. He writes, teaches, speaks about the history of the U.S. labor movement, especially the New York City labor movement. So why don't we start with that? Josh, welcome to Talking History.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What got you interested in labor history in the first place, before we go into the specifics of your work?
Well, I think it was a couple things. I was not a history major as an undergraduate, actually. I just always enjoyed reading history. And one of the things that sort of puzzled me, in a way I think it's the issue that I've always been working on ever since, was I was born in the late 1940s. I was born in 1949. And it seemed like the world just before I was born was so turbulent, you know, with the Depression and the New Deal and these new unions. And yet my memories was a fairly placid society of the sort of 50s and 60s, you know, till things later in the 60s kind of changed. I always sort of thought, well, what happened? You know, I mean, what was that transition? So I started thinking about, you know, what were the social forces that had been so active in change in the New Deal era and so forth. And I guess labor looms so large. And of course, there's a lot of drama, you know, frankly, in labor history. They're just great stories. And I guess that aspect of history has always attracted me. So I got interested in it, and I was, you know, particularly interested in the relationship of labor and politics and social change. And, you know, that led me to my first book, which was a study of one particular union, which is in New York City. It's the union of the people who run the buses and subways, the Transport Workers Union. And I was drawn to it in part because it was very politically active. It was a very left-wing union, but also since it represented these workers who were involved in the public service, it inevitably got drawn into a lot of things. So that's sort of where it began, and one thing led to another, and I'm kind of still at it quite a few years later.
And most of your work focuses on New York City.
Primarily. It primarily has. I've done some other stuff. I was part of a project that wrote a textbook on American labor history called Who Built America? And that was a national scope study, and that was nice because it got me out of the streets of New York and into the mining towns of, you know, West Virginia and the West, and gave me kind of broader context to understand the New York story, because in some ways New York is a idiosyncratic place.
Now, how difficult is it writing a labor history of a city as large as New York?
Well, writing histories of big places or big institutions is kind of inherently hard, just because a lot of things happen. And some things that you might be able to do in a smaller place, you can't. I mean, I know, for example, some of the studies of 19th century labor unions or labor communities, you could actually go back to the census and almost look at every individual person. You know, when you're talking about a town of 30,000, when you sort of eliminate the children, the retired, and you could actually look at, you know, the occupation of everyone. You just can't do something like that for New York. So there's a kind of issue of scale, which makes it extremely complicated. And I think it also requires a kind of selectivity. You have to look for representative developments or representative institutions. And that's a little tricky because, you know, the very strategy there is it comes from the fact you can't look at everything. So you kind of have to gamble that what you're investing your time in are things that tell you something about the broader story. And you know, of course, it leads you open to criticism that says, you know, why'd you leave out my dad's union or this or that? And, you know, I'm sure it was an interesting story. You just can't do everything. So I think it does, you know, impose certain kinds of challenges which are different than looking at smaller places.
It must. I know that with respect to some unions, over 50% of their membership comes from New York City.
Sure,
so
that's right.
It must be you're essentially studying these unions. Or...
Yes, that's right. I mean, you have these kind of lopsided unions. In fact, the union I mentioned that I started with, the Transport Workers Union, it starts as a New York union. It then expands. It's now in the airlines and the railways and a number of other things. But it's always unsure, you know, what's the you know, tail and what's the dog. In fact, it's funny because right now there's a big dispute between the national union and the New York local, and they're sort of putting a little distance between themselves, and they decide they shouldn't be in the same building. Well, it turns out that the building which the national union is headquartered is owned by the New York City local. So the national union is sort of moving out, which is the sort of reverse that you'd find in most places. So that's certainly true in the garment unions and a few others were very heavily concentrated in New York, which after Washington, D.C., was the second largest headquarters city for national unions, and quite a few of the white-collar unions, professional type of unions, newspaper guild, entertainment unions were headquartered there, the garment unions, United Electrical Workers was centered there, some of the public sector unions. So there is that kind of a challenge. Frankly, with that many unions, there's also more paper generated than you can realistically look at. So you have to make some choices. There were some very important unions with good collections of records, which I just did not look at. I had to make a, limit someplace.
Now we're talking now specifically about your recent book, I guess. Well, recent, is it? 1999?
Came out in hardcover about a year and a half ago and came out paperback about 6 months ago.
6 months ago. Working Class New York, Life and Labor Since World War II. And I'm going to, why don't we just jump into it? Because you, in the introduction, the first page of the introduction, you have a sentence that reads as follows. The story of working class New York is one of triumph and confinement. Why don't we begin with that sentence and then get into more detail on the arguments that you make?
Sure. Well, I think, doing this book, I decided to do this book because I had a sense there was a story here. I mean, I had a sense that labor was important in understanding modern New York City history. And also, I had a sense, by the way, that New York City workers were important in understanding national labor history. And both those things seemed to me not to have been paid enough attention to, that the history of New York was often told without much about the history of New York workers and unions, particularly in the modern era, not so much in the Triangle Fire days. There's lots about labor then, but when you're talking about the 50s and the 60s and the 40s and the 80s. And also, by the way, I also have the feeling that post-World War II labor, it's as if every worker lived in Detroit or Pittsburgh and not in places like Albany or New York City. So I wanted to rectify those two omissions. But what I discovered as I started doing the work, and this is where the triumph comes from, was the tremendous role that workers, particularly through unions, but also through other means, played in shaping the development of New York after World War II. And for, a good quarter century, the whole path of development, physically, socially, culturally, of New York City, was to a considerable measure, reflective of what its working population was doing and what they were trying to achieve. So that's the triumph. I mean, I think the confinement comes with the way in which this very successful labor movement, defined very broadly, unions, ethnic organizations, and so forth, ultimately begins to bump against limits. And although it continues to this day to be very important, no longer has quite the sort of social influence, the clout that once did. So that's in a few sentences the trajectory of the book.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get into the details. Explain a little bit about how trade union organizations are structured in a city like New York. I know that there are various joint boards and district councils and union locals. Is there a structure in a large city like New York that's different than how unionism is organized in smaller communities?
Well, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I mean, the basic citywide organizations in New York City are central labor councils. And back in the pre-merger days, there was an AFL Central Labor Council and the CIO Central Labor Council in New York City. And that's pretty typical of even fairly small cities in the United States. So those structures were there. But I think what was a little different was that within many individual industries, there were regional bodies, which often were very, very important. And I think this reflects not just the size of New York, but the nature of the economy in New York. New York was a very heavily unionized city with a lot of blue-collar work. But it wasn't a center of heavy industry that we usually think about. There were no steel mills or auto plants. So there were very few employers that had 2, 3, 5, 10,000 workers. And in fact, when they did, they tended not to be industrial. They tended to be department stores or insurance companies or government agencies. So the model that came out of the 1930s in many places, that had these giant unions like the auto workers that had locals of 10, 20,000, you didn't have that in New York. You really had almost an older style of organization where you had people organized by a particular craft. Let's say in the garment industry, you might have cutters and cut out the fabric in one local pressers who pressed, you know, the final clothing before it was shipped off in a separate local and so forth. And then joining those various locals together, there would be some sort of joint board or district council. By the way, sometimes they were not by job or by occupation. Sometimes they were by language. You had Italian cloak makers had their own local. You know, the Jewish cloak makers had their own local. So you had smaller unions that reflected the complexity of the economy, of the ethnic mix. But then to sort of create unity, to be able to act in solidarity, you had these sort of joint boards. And that model became very prevalent in New York and still is. For example, the municipal workers today, one of the largest unions, are organized that way. Many locals, a district council, and it's the district council level where the real power is.
Did you mentioned the ethnic organizations. Mm-hmm. How significant was ethnicity in building unity and building and creating this unity in New York?
Well, it's both. I mean, as you imply, you know, it's New York was still very much a city of immigrants when World War II ended. The first two post-war mayors were foreign-born, although it was becoming more a city of the children of immigrants. You know, that was the kind of generation that was coming into its own. And people lived in neighborhoods which were often very ethnically defined. So this could be a source of great solidarity in many industries, for example, transit. Many of the workers were Irish, Irish-born Irish. They tended to live in Irish neighborhoods. So they not only had relationships on the job, but they had relationships in the neighborhood. Then they belonged to the same Irish County Association. They were almost all Catholic. They had relations to, you know, fraternal groups, the Catholic Church. So you could have a kind of deep interweaving that could create great solidarity and community mobilization on behalf of workers when crises arose. On the other hand, sometimes you had a lot of tension between ethnic groups. And here the record's very mixed. But, for example, the public school system, tremendous tensions between Catholics and Jews in the workforce. Through the 1930s, it had been a heavily female Irish Catholic workforce. Then many Jewish teachers came into the system in the 30s. And there were great divisions. And this impacted unionism, which was pretty weak, in part for that reason. It sometimes burst out in incidents of alleged discrimination, and so it could be pretty counterproductive. I think, though, you know, and maybe this is my rosy glasses looking backwards, all things considered, there was a remarkable degree of solidarity. I think there were, because there was a lot of shared experience across ethnic lines, you know, both in terms of work, but the kinds of lives people lived. You know, they shared problems. Whether it was, you know, overcrowded subways or the lack of affordable housing or fear of gangs, which is a big, you know, fear in New York in the 1950s, or insufficient wages or companies beginning to move out of town. And I think those shared experiences created practical reasons for joining together. So there are certainly plenty of problems, but all things considered, I think that this is mostly a story of solidarity.
Well, before we talk about the solidarity, though, and you're referring to the teachers, I'm remembering one of the stories you tell in the book is about Mae Quinn, the teacher. Maybe you should tell us.
This is a long, involved story. It's a fascinating one. I thought, you know, when I first discovered the story, this was a story strictly about, you know, anti-communism and McCarthyism and so forth, but it turned out to be a much more complicated story. Mae Quinn was a cause célèbre of the mid-1940s in New York, and Mae Quinn was a school teacher in Brooklyn and rather conservative Irish Catholic woman who said some things like, you know, well, Hitler wasn't all bad for the German people, and a few things like that, which I think to our ears would be extremely grating, and to some of her co-workers' ears were extremely grating, and her co-workers brought her up on charges of anti-Americanism. And it's interesting because these were left-wing colleagues of hers who were charging her with, you know, un-Americanism, something we think of going the other way a little later on. And they actually complained to the school bureaucracy, and the school bureaucracy said, well, you know, we'll look at this and this and this. And then some political pressure grew up, and eventually there was a kind of big investigation, and she was essentially, you know, slapped on the wrist. But she didn't want to leave it there. She sued her accusers of, I can't remember exactly what, a libel, and it became a court case right at the end of World War II. And she lost the case. And this is also very interesting to me because it's got this strange echo of a later very famous case, the Alger Hiss case, where, you know, people not leaving it well enough alone, you know, are going into court, sometimes it boomerangs. And that's what happened to this teacher, Ms. Quinn, because various state senators got hold of it and they said she should be fired, and there were big demands that she be removed, and the labor movement got involved and they sort of picketed and this and that. And the school system, although it did sort of, you know, reprimand her and so forth, really kind of dug in her heels. And this became a source of kind of great tension between primarily Jewish, liberal, and left-wing teachers and their backers in the labor movement, and Mae Quinn and her more conservative, primarily Catholic supporters, and the Catholic Church itself, which really lined up very strongly. And so you see something which on one hand is a kind of political dispute, it's a kind of early example of a kind of Cold War dispute, and yet in other ways it's a kind of rivalry both for jobs within the public school system and influence within the public school system, which is very ethnically polarized. It gives me a laugh when people talk about affirmative action today as it's a new thing. You know, in the New York City public school system in the 1940s, it was totally organized by ethnicity. The school board had 9 seats. 3 went to the Catholics, 3 went to the Protestants, 3 went to the Jews. There were quotas. Everyone knew it, you know. Nothing, you know, subtle about this. So it's about that. And it's also about kind of cultural rivalry. I mean, one of the things I think that was going on was, with World War II, there was a lot of change, you know, in New York and elsewhere in the country. A lot of African Americans moved up to the big cities to take defense jobs. Women went to work. The kind of family in which a woman was at home and the man went out to the job became somewhat less common. And I think for someone like Mae Quinn, that was very distressing. She had a kind of certain sense of what kind of America, what kind of New York she lived in. It was all being sort of mixed up. And I think she thought of herself as kind of defending this. And suddenly she'd be calling un-American for doing this. So it's a kind of fascinating sense of the turbulence that the war and ethnic change and racial change was undergoing. Later on, the tables would be turned, and it would be the Jewish teachers, the left-wing Jewish teachers, who would be accused of being un-American, and many of them were fired, and many of them were very bitter. I found all these kind of postcards to the Board of Ed, you know, what about Mae Quinn? You know, why were we fired? And she was, you know, kept on just being slapped on the wrist, and they saw this very explicitly in terms of anti-Semitism. They felt that they were victims of anti-Semitism, and she'd benefited from anti-Semitism. So this, you know, now this is some utterly obscure thing, you know, but in its day, it was quite a big case.
I was fascinated by the story because the tables were about to turn when this was taking place, and which takes us into the Cold War, and that's really both the book In Transit, the Transport Workers Union in New York City, and this book deals a lot with the Cold War and the implications that the Cold War had for labor. Could you go into that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I spent a tremendous amount of time, and I don't feel satisfied yet, you know, in trying to understand this. And you know, the original chapter I wrote on the Cold War was 120 pages. My publisher, they were like, forget it. This is a separate book. Get rid of this. And I have a much shorter version. But in some ways, the story in New York is similar to the rest of the country. I mean, you know, as the international Cold War develops and, you know, political alliances internationally harden, anti-communism at home grows. I think what's different about New York is that the left had real power. It had tremendous amount of influence in many unions, in the cultural establishment, in political life, so that when people sort of, you know, talked about fears of sort of communist influence or something, this was an abstraction in many other places where, you know, left-wingers were kind of gadflies, you know, and maybe useful stirs of, you know, of provocative thinking. In New York, they had a lot of institutional power. So this was a real drag-out battle in New York because it wasn't simply about ideas or sort of symbols. This was really about the control of big institutions, big unions, network radio, which was back, you know, then based in New York City, the schools, other things like that. So New York was a tremendous center of left-wing unionism and the left in general, both communist and socialist. It was also a real center of anti-communism. Many of the most famous anti-communist newspaper columnists, for example, were in New York, and you had the Hearst Press headquartered in New York, which was very vehemently anti-communist. So it was a tremendously prolonged battle where you had sort of two sides that could give and sustain repeated blows. In a certain sense, in the end, the outcome was inevitable. I mean, this New York is part of the national scene, and, with the whole legal framework, the national political and cultural framework moving so strongly in the anti-communist direction, inevitably the left in New York would be weakened. And it was. And many left-wing institutions were destroyed or seriously weakened. But in some other regards, the left-wing labor movement and some other left-wing institutions were able to kind of weather the storm, not completely successfully, but by sort of fighting very hard, trying to limit their losses, and to some extent by the mid-50s, kind of keeping their heads down a bit, they were able to survive through a lot of fancy footwork, reaffiliations, redefining themselves, and so forth. And I think this is important because there's a kind of continuity in New York that I think maybe is not there in much of the country between the days of the 30s and the early 40s when the left was very strong and the 60s and the 70s. And that, you think of someone like, for example, Mo Foner, who recently died, who was a leader of one of the hospital workers' unions and, had been a communist. He himself got disenchanted and left the Communist Party, but always remained quite left-wing and, managed to hang on with the, hospital union, which was pretty marginal and headed by this guy named Leon Davis, who had also been a communist. And in the early 50s, they were being called to the congressional committees. Their union was barely sort of hanging on. And yet they did hang on. They eventually had left the CIO. They went back into the CIO. The AFL-CIO happened. And then in the late 50s, they set out to organize hospital workers in New York. And they had a kind of vision, which I think is directly connected to their earlier leftism. They were very anti-racist, so they were very open to organizing what was a heavily non-white workforce in the lower paid jobs in the healthcare system. They had a very strong sense of sort of solidarity, mass mobilization, and they were able to win over the mainstream of the labor movement to support their efforts. And out of this comes 1199, which, was once this tiny little union, but they made it into something completely different. And today, I believe it's the biggest union in New York City. It's got some 200,000 members. And Dennis Rivera, who's now the head of it, is a very big power in New York state politics. And, I think statewide, they've got a rapid expansion upstate hospitals. So, there's a kind of continuity here, that you don't see every place. And that's, I think, an example of the way the left did survive. Other stories aren't always so happy. I mean, some of these unions got pretty creamed and didn't, or else they survived, but with their special character kind of gone. I'm thinking, for example, of the electrical workers, which was another very big left-wing union in New York. And they did eventually merge with another union, and they did survive, but I think they survived at the cost of kind of keeping their head low, and they lost the ability to organize new companies, and they became a kind of maintenance operation, and they weren't able to provide the kind of leadership and the vitality that they once did before the Cold War really hit.
When the unions began to decline in the, I guess starting in the 60s up through the present, numerically, how did that manifest itself in New York City? Was New York relatively insulated from the decline, or did it also follow the trend, the national trend?
Well, New York has had a fairly steady level of unionization over the last 50, 60 years. Now, it's actually pretty hard to measure because there are no statistics kept in the United States on union membership by city. You get it by state, but you can't get it by city. So all you have is kind of self-reported statistics by unions, which are notoriously inaccurate, and people's guesses. But something between a quarter and a third of the New York workforce was unionized when World War II ended, and probably something like a quarter to a third is unionized today. There may be something of a decline, but it's not that great. And I think there are a number of reasons for this. One is that the union movement was more diversified in New York. to begin with. It wasn't just manufacturing. There was a lot of transportation, a lot of public utilities, but there were also wholesale and retail workers. The big department stores, for example, in New York, were unionized by the 40s and remain so today, which is not true in many places. Even some clerical workers, even some professionals were unionized. And then starting in the 60s, as manufacturing began to slide, and that was very unionized, you had the tremendous explosion of public sector unionism. And New York's got a very big government, you know, not only New York City government, but we have state government workers and federal government workers and port authority workers and so forth. And those groups all got brought into the labor movement. And that's a huge, literally hundreds of thousands of people. So that kind of compensated for the drop. And then the organization of service workers, particularly the hospital workers, the story I just told, that's substantial numbers of people. So by successfully expanding into the public employees and the service workers, the New York labor movement was able to maintain its strength relatively well and far, far better than, you know, the country as a whole, if you step back and look at that.
Now, these new pink-collar and white-collar workers, is this a very different type of unionism than existed in the 30s and 40s even?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in some ways, it's very similar. You know, it depends on what you're looking at. You know, for example, a municipal employee in New York who belongs to the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, a lot of ways, it's like the old garment unions. These are not that well-paid workers, even with a union, you know. But it's a union that's very successful in providing a lot of benefits and protections so that they have retirements to look forward to. They've got pretty good health care. They've got a lot of protections that the higher paid workers in much of the country don't have, you know. And then the union itself is a great center of life. They have, you know, classes. They have African-American month celebrations. They have Latino month celebrations. Now they have South Indian celebrations as the workforce changes. They've got children's classes, music lessons. You could get a BA, you know, anything under the sun. So it's a very rich life. It's a union culture, you know, and in that sense, it's very similar. Now, in other ways, it's a little different because in terms of collective bargaining, you know, the public employee unions have to look very much to state and local budget issues and taxation issues, and they want a big government in a certain way. They want high taxes because it benefits their workers, and they may not be as interested in economic development issues that, let's say, the construction trades or the manufacturing workers may be in, and they may not be as concerned about the loss of blue-collar jobs. So there are some tensions, I think, often kind of behind the scenes. You don't see them very much in public, but there is a fair amount of tension. And really, the public unions have taken over the leadership of the labor movement since, you know, the late 60s, early 70s in New York City. And I think that some of the private sector workers and their unions do not think this has served them as well as maybe the earlier labor leadership had.
Now, have new immigrants been assimilated effectively into the new union structures?
Yes and no. I mean, for example, public sector, I think the basic answer is yes. And today you have a lot of, for example, Caribbean workers or now South Asian workers who are becoming active in unions. It takes a while. And I think there were also some good examples of unions organizing new immigrant workforces. For example, Chinatown garment industry is unionized, which is not great jobs, but it's unionized. And there have been a few construction trades which are heavily immigrant. For example, demolition work, which had been pretty much non-union and was organized over the last 10 years. And that's heavily Eastern European immigrants in many of those jobs. And those, I think, are examples of some positive. Another example would be some of the limousine drivers who are from India and Bangladesh and Pakistan, and they have their own so unions, which have been pretty effective. But there's a tremendous amount of immigrant labor in New York that's non-unionized that really the union movement has barely scratched. Some of these are illegal immigrants, some of them aren't. Many of them are working for immigrant employers, you know, in local food stores, in small manufacturing firms, in local service industries. And each of these particular companies is very small, but taken together, they're huge. And I don't think those groups have been brought into the labor movement yet. And I think, you know, the labor leadership's aware of this problem. I think, in theory, they're all gung-ho to, you know, kind of address it. But I don't think, in practice, for whatever reason, they've gotten very far yet.
How about women? How have they fared in New York City's unions?
Well, New York always had an unusually high percentage of women in unions compared to the rest of the country. Some of it was because the garment industry was so big in New York and there were a lot of garment workers. And then, of course, the fact that public employees became unionized pretty early. Teachers, that's another huge, you know, heavily female thing. And retail trade, you know, which is a lot of women. So New York was unusual in the percentage of the union movement that was female. It was typical in the percentage of the union leadership as opposed to that was female, which is very low. You know, it was a male-dominated movement at the highest levels, and it still is. You know, I mean, you have some exceptions. You know, the head of the teachers' union, the head of the municipal workers' union are both female right now. And certainly over the last 10, 15 years, there have been other examples. But I think it's not proportionate, you know, and I think, you know, I remember AFL-CIO President John Sweeney said, you know, the labor leadership has to, you know, have the same face as, you know, the American workforce. And that's not true yet, at least on the upper levels of the labor leadership, when you get to the issue of gender.